the Institute. They would not put themselves at risk for her. Only a few weeks ago, he would have said the same thing about himself. Now, knowing Charlotte, he realized to his surprise the idea of risking himself for her seemed an honor, as it would be to most Englishmen to risk themselves for the Queen.
"How does one make the portal work?"
Cecily asked, glancing at the glowing archways as if it were a painting in a gallery, her dark head cocked to the side.
"It will transport you instantly from one place to another," said Henry. "But the trick is, well, that part is magic."
He said the word a little nervously. "You need to be picturing the place you're going to," said Magnus. "It won't work to take you to a place you have never been and cannot imagine. In this case, to get to Cata Idris, you're going to need Cecily. Cecily, how close to Cata Idris do you believe you can bring us?"
"To the very top," Cecily said confidently. "There are several paths that will bring you up the mountain, and I have walked two of them with my father. I can remember the crest of the mountain."
"Excellent," Henry said. "Cecily, you will stand before the portal and visualize our destination."
"But she's not going first, is she?" Gabriel demanded. The moment the words were out of his mouth, he was startled. He hadn't meant to say them. Yeah, well, in for a penny, in for a pound, though, he thought.
"I meant, she's the least trained of us all. It wouldn't be safe."
"I can go through first," Cecily said, looking as if she were not in the least grateful for Gabriel's support.
"I see no reason why..." "Henry!"
It was Charlotte, reappearing at the foot of the steps. Behind her were the servants of the Institute, all in training gear. Bridget, looking as if she were out for a morning stroll. Cyril, set and determined. And Sophie, carrying a large leather bag. Behind them were three more men, tall men, in parchment robes, moving with peculiar gliding motions. Silent Brothers. Unlike any other Silent Brothers that Gabriel had seen before, though, these were armed. Weapons belts were cinched around their waists, over their robes, and from their belts hung long, curved blades, their hilts made of shimmering adamas, the same material used to make steles and serif blades. Henry looked up, puzzled, then guiltily from the portal to the brothers. His lightly freckled face paled.
"Brother Enoch," he said, "I..."
"Calm yourself." The Silent Brother's voice rang out in all their minds. "We have not come to warn you of any possible breach of the law, Henry Branwell. We have come to fight with you."
"To fight with us?"
Gideon looked amazed.
"But Silent Brothers don't... I mean, they aren't warriors."
"That is incorrect. Shadow hunters we were and shadow hunters we remain. Even when changed to become brothers, we were founded by Jonathan Shadowhunter himself, and though we live by the book, we may yet die by the sword if we choose."
Charlotte was beaming.
"They landed my message," she said. "They came. Brother Enoch, Brother Micah, and Brother Zachariah."
The two brothers behind Enoch inclined their heads silently. Gabriel fought off a shiver. He'd always found the Silent Brothers eerie, though he knew they were an integral part of Shadowhunter life.
"Brother Enoch also told me why no one else came," Charlotte said, the smile vanishing from her face. "Consul Whalen convened a council meeting this morning, though he told us nothing of it. Attendance for all the Shadowhunters was mandatory by law."
Henry's breath hissed out through his teeth.
"That bad man," he finished, with a quick glance at Cecily, who rolled her eyes. "What's the council meeting about?"
"Replacing us as heads of the Institute," Charlotte said. "He still believes Mortmain's attack will come against London, and that a strong leader here is needed to stand against the Clockwork Army."
"Mrs. Branwell!"
Sophie, in the act of handing to Magnus the bag that she had been carrying, nearly dropped it.
"They can't do that!"
"Oh, they very well can," said Charlotte.
She looked around at all their faces and raised her chin. In that moment, despite her small size, Gabriel thought, she seemed taller than the consul. "We all knew this would come," she said. "It does not matter. We are shadow hunters, and our duty is to each other and to what we think is right. We believe will, and we believe in will. Faith has brought us this far. It will bring us a little farther. The angel watches over us, and we shall win out. Everyone was silent. Gabriel looked around at their faces, determined, every one. And even Magnus seemed, if not moved or convinced, considering and respectful. "Mrs. Branwell," he said at last, "if Consul Whalen does not consider you a leader, he is a fool." Charlotte inclined her head toward him. "Thank you," she said. "But we should waste no more time. We must go, and quickly, for this matter can wait on us no longer." Henry looked for a long moment at his wife, and then toward Cecily. "Are you ready?" Will's sister nodded and moved forward to stand before the portal. Its gleaming light cast the shadow of unfamiliar runes across her small, determined face. "Visualize," said Magnus. "Imagine as hard as you can that you are looking at the top of Cata Idris." Cecily's hands clenched at her sides. As she stared, the portal began to move, the runes to ripple and change. The darkness within the archway lightened. Suddenly, Gabriel was no longer looking at shadow. He was gazing at a portrait of a landscape that could have been painted within the portal. The green curve at the top of a mountain, a lake as blue and deep as the sky. Cecily gave a little gasp, and then, unprompted, stepped forward and vanished through the archway. It was like watching a sketch being erased. First her hands vanished into the portal, and then her arms, outstretched, and then her body. And she was gone. Charlotte gave a little shriek. "Henry!" There was a buzzing in Gabriel's ears. He could hear Henry reassuring Charlotte that this was the way the portal was meant to function, that nothing untoward had happened. But it was like a song half heard from another room, the words a rhythm without meaning. All he knew was that Cecily, braver than all of them, had stepped through the unknown doorway and was gone. And he could not let her go alone. He moved forward. He heard his brother call his name, but he ignored him. Pushing past Gideon, he reached the portal and stepped through it. For a moment there was nothing but blackness. Then a great hand seemed to reach out of the darkness and snatch hold of him, and he was pulled into the whirling, inky maelstrom. The great council room was full of people shouting. On the raised platform at the center stood Consul Whalen, staring out at the shouting throng with a look of furious impatience on his face. His dark eyes raked the shadow hunters congregated in front of him. George Penhallow was locked in a screaming match with Sora Kaidu of the Tokyo Institute. Vijay Malhotra was jabbing a thin finger into the chest of Japheth Pangborn, who rarely left his manor house in the Idris countryside these days, and who had turned as red as a tomato at the indignity of it all. Two of the Blackwells had cornered Amelia Morgenstern, who was snapping at them in German. Aloysius Starkweather, all in black, stood beside one of the wooden benches, his wiry limbs nearly bent up around his ears as he glared up at the podium with sharp old eyes. The Inquisitor, standing beside Consul Whalen, slammed his wooden staff down against the floor, hard enough to nearly shatter the floorboards. "That is enough!" he roared. "All of you will be silent, and you will be silent now! Sit down!" A ripple of shock went through the room, and, to the Consul's evident surprise, they sat. Not quietly, but they sat, all who had room to sit. The chamber was filled to bursting. This many shadow hunters rarely appeared at any one meeting. There were representatives here from all the institutes. New York, Bangkok, Geneva, Bombay, Kyoto, Buenos Aires. Only the London shadow hunters, Charlotte Branwell and her cohorts, were absent. Only Aloysius Starkweather remained standing, his ragged dark cloak flapping about him like crow's wings.
"Where is Charlotte Branwell?" he demanded. "It was understood from the message you sent out that you'd be here to explain the contents of her message to the council." "I will explain the contents of her message," said the consul through gritted teeth.
"It would be preferable to hear it from her," said Malhotra, his dark eyes keen as he looked from the consul to the Inquisitor and back. Inquisitor Whitelaw looked drawn,
as if he had suffered recent sleepless nights. His mouth was tight at the corners.
"Charlotte Branwell is overreacting," said the consul. "I take full responsibility for having put her in charge of the London Institute. It was something I should never have done. She has been relieved of her position." "I have had occasion to meet and speak with Mrs. Branwell," said Starkweather, in his hoarse Yorkshire tones. "She does not strike me as someone who would easily overreact."
Looking as if he remembered exactly why he had been so glad Starkweather had ceased attending council meetings, the consul said tightly,
"She is in a delicate way, and I believe she has become overset."
Chatter and confusion. The Inquisitor looked over at Wayland and gave him a narrow glance of disgust. The consul returned his look with a glare. It was clear that the two men had been arguing. The consul was flushed with anger. The look he bent toward the Inquisitor in return filled with betrayal. It was clear that Whitelaw did not agree with the consul's words. A woman rose to her feet from the crowded benches. She had white hair piled on her head and an imperious manner. The consul looked as if he were groaning inwardly. Calida Fairchild, Charlotte Branwell's aunt.
"If you are suggesting," she said in a frozen voice, "that my niece is making hysterical and unreasonable decisions because she is carrying one of the next generation of shadow hunters, consul, I suggest you think again."
The consul ground his teeth.
"There is no evidence that Charlotte Branwell's statements, that Moraine is in Wales, have any truth to them," he said. "It all stems from the reports of Will Herondale, who is only a boy, and a reprehensibly irresponsible one at that. All evidence, including the journals of Benedict Lightwood, point to an attack on London, and it is there we must marshal our forces."
A buzz went through the room. The words, "an attack on London," repeated over and over. Amalia Morgenstern fanned herself with a lace handkerchief, while Lillian Highsmith, her fingers stroking the haft of a dagger protruding from the wrist of one glove, looked delighted.
"Evidence," snapped Kalida. "My niece's word is evidence."
There was another rustle, and a young woman rose to her feet. She wore a bright green dress and a defiant expression. The last time the consul had seen her, she had been sobbing in the same council room, demanding justice. Tatiana Blackthorne, nay, Lightwood.
"The consul is right about Charlotte Branwell," she exclaimed. "Charlotte Branwell and William Herondale are the reason my husband is dead."
"Oh?"
It was Inquisitor Whitelaw, his tone dripping with sarcasm.
"Who exactly killed your husband? Was it Will?"
There was a murmur of astonishment. Tatiana looked outraged.
"It was not my father's fault."
"On the contrary,"
interrupted the Inquisitor.
"This was kept from public knowledge, Mrs. Blackthorne, but you'll force my hand. We opened an investigation into the matter of your husband's death, and it was determined that your father was indeed at fault. Most grievous fault. If it were not for the actions of your brothers, and of William Herondale and Charlotte Branwell, among the others of the London Institute, the name of Lightwood would have been stricken from the Shadow Hunter records, and you would be living the rest of your life as a friendless mundane."
Tatiana turned beet red and clenched her fists.
"William Herondale has offered me insults unspeakable to a lady. I fail to see how that is germane to the matter at hand," said the Inquisitor. "One may be rude in one's personal life, but also correct about larger matters." "You took our house,"
Tatiana screeched.
"I am forced to rely on the generosity of my husband's family, like some starving beggar."
The Inquisitor's eyes were glittering to match the stones in his rings.
"Your house was confiscated, Mrs. Blackthorne, not stolen. We searched the Lightwood family house," he went on, raising his voice. "It was full of evidence of the elder Mr. Lightwood's connections to Mortmain. Journals detailing acts vile and filthy and unspeakable. The consul cites the man's journals as evidence that there will be an attack on London. But by the time Benedict Lightwood died, he was mad with demon pox. Nor is it likely Mortmain would have confided his true plans to him, even had he been sane."
Looking nearly desperate, Consul Wayland interrupted.
"The matter of Benedict Lightwood is closed," closed and irrelevant. We are here to discuss the matters on Warpmane and the Institute. First, as Charlotte Branwell has been removed from the position, and the situation facing us is centered most heavily upon London, we require a new leader of the London Enclave. I'm going to throw the floor open. Does anyone wish to step forward as her replacement?
There was a rustle and murmur. George Penhallow had begun to rise to his feet when the Inquisitor burst in furiously.
This is ridiculous, Desire. There is no proof yet that Mortmain is not where Charlotte says he will be. We have not even begun to discuss sending reinforcements after her.
After her? What do you mean, after her?
The Inquisitor swept an arm out at the throng.
She's not here. Where do you think the inhabitants of the London Institute are?
They have gone to Kader Idris after the Magister. And yet, instead of discussing whether we shall give them aid, we convene a council to discuss Charlotte's replacement. The consul's temper snapped.
There will be no aid, he roared. There will never be aid for those who...
But the council never found out who was destined to go unaided, for at that moment, a steel blade, deadly sharp, whipped through the air behind the consul and neatly severed his head from his body. The Inquisitor jerked back, reaching for his staff as blood sheeted across him. The consul's body fell, tumbling to the ground in two severed parts, his body slumping to the blood-wet floor of the podium, while his severed head rolled away like a tennis ball. As he collapsed, revealed behind him was an automaton, as spindly as a human skeleton, dressed in the ragged remains of a red military tunic. It grinned like a skull as it retracted its scarlet-drenched blade and looked out upon the silent, stunned crowd of Shadowhunters. The only other sound in the room came from Aloysius Starkweather, who was laughing steadily and softly, apparently to himself.
"She told you," he wheezed. "She told you what would happen."
A moment later, the automaton had moved forward, its clawed hand shooting out to close about Aloysius's throat. Blood burst from the old man's throat as the creature lifted him off his feet, still grinning. The Shadowhunters began to shout, and then the doors burst open, and a flood of clockwork creatures poured into the room.
"Well," said a very amused voice, "this is unexpected."
Tessa sat bolt upright, pulling the heavy coverlet around her. Beside her, Will stirred, propping himself up on his elbows, eyelids fluttering open slowly.
"What?"
The room was filled with bright light. The torches had come on at full strength, and it was like the place was lit with daylight. Tessa could see the wreck of the room that they had made, their clothes scattered across the floor and the bed, the rug before the fireplace rucked up, the bedclothes wound about them. On the other side of the invisible wall was lounging a familiar figure in an elegant dark suit, one thumb hooked around the waistband of his trousers, his cat-pupiled eyes glimmering with mirth. Magnus Bane.
"You might want to get up," he said. "Everyone will be here quite soon to rescue you, and you may prefer to have clothes on when they arrive."
He shrugged.
"I would, at any rate, but then I'm well known to be remarkably shy."
Will swore in Welsh. He was sitting up now, the covers tucked about his waist, and he had done his best to move his body to shield Tessa from Magnus's gaze. He was without a shirt, of course, and in the brighter light, Tessa could see where the tan on his hands and face faded into the paler white of his chest and shoulders. The white star mark on his shoulder gleamed out like a light, and she saw Magnus's eyes go to it and narrow.
"Interesting," he said.
Will made an incoherent noise of protest.
"Interesting? By the angel, Magnus."
Magnus gave him a wry look. There was something in it, something that made Tessa feel as if Magnus knew something they didn't.
"If I were a different person, I would have a lot to say to you right now," he said.
"I appreciate your restraint."
"You won't soon," said Magnus shortly. Then he reached up, as if he were knocking on a door, and tapped the invisible wall between them. It was like watching someone plunge their hand into water. Ripples spread out from the place where his fingers touched, and suddenly the wall slid away and was gone in a shower of blue sparks. "Here," the warlock said, and tossed a tied leather sack
onto the foot of the bed.
I brought gear. I thought you might be in need of clothing. I didn't realize quite how in need. Tessa glared at him around Will's shoulder.
How did you find us here? How did you know?
Which of the others are with you? Are they all right? Yes. Quite a few of them are hurrying through this place looking for you. Now get dressed, he said, and turned his back, giving them privacy. Tessa, mortified, reached for the sack on the bed, scrabbled through it until she found her gear, and then stood up with the sheet wrapped around her body and dashed behind the tall Chinese screen in the corner of the room. She did not look at Will as she went. She couldn't bring herself to. How could she look at him without thinking of what they'd done, wondering if he was horrified, if he couldn't believe either of them would do such a thing after Jem? Viciously, she yanked on the gear. Thank goodness the gear, unlike dresses, could be assembled on the body without recourse to help from anyone else. Through the screen, she heard Magnus explaining to Will that he and Henry had managed, through a combination of magic and invention, to create a portal that would transport them from London to Cadda Idris. She could see them only in silhouette, but she saw Will nodding in relief as Magnus listed those who would come with him. Henry, Charlotte, the Lightwood brothers, Cyril, Sophie, Cecily, Bridget, and a group of the Silent Brothers. At the mention of his sister's name, Will began to pull on his clothes with even greater haste, and by the time Tessa stepped out from behind the screen, he was entirely dressed in gear, his boots laced up, his hands buckling on his weapons belt. As he saw her, his face broke into a tentative smile. "The others have all spread out through the tunnels to find you," Magnus said. "We were meant to take half an hour to search, and then meet up in a central chamber. I'll give you two a moment to, collect yourselves," he smirked, and pointed to the door. "I shall be outside in the corridor." The moment the door closed behind him, Tessa was in Will's arms, her hands locked about his neck.
"Oh, by the angel," she said. "That was mortifying."
Will slid his hands into her hair, and he was kissing her eyelids and her cheeks and then her mouth, quickly, but with fervor and concentration, as if nothing could be more important.
"Listen to you," he said. "You said by the angel, like a shadow hunter."
He kissed the side of her mouth.
"I love you. God, I love you. I waited so long to say it."
She curved her hands about the sides of his waist, holding him there, the material of his gear rough beneath her fingertips.
"Will," she said hesitantly, "you're not sorry."
"Sorry?" He looked at her in disbelief.
"Nah, Tim. You're mad if you think I'm sorry, Tess."
His knuckle brushed her cheek.
"There is more, so much more I want to say to you."
"No," she teased. "Will Herondale with more to say." He ignored this.
"But now is not the time. Not with Mortmain breathing down our necks, most likely, and Magnus outside the door. Now is the time to finish this. But when it's over, Tess, I will say everything to you I've always wanted to say. As for now..."
He kissed her temple and released her, his eyes searching her face.
"I need to know you believe me when I say I love you. That is all."
"I believe everything you say," Tessa said with a smile, her hands creeping down from his waist to his weapons belt. Her fingers closed on the hilt of a dagger, and she yanked it from the belt, smiling as he looked down at her in surprise. She kissed his cheek and stepped back. "After all," she said, "you weren't lying about that tattoo of the Dragon of Wales, were you?" The room reminded Cecily of the inside of St. Paul's Dome, which Will had taken her to see on one of his less disagreeable days after she had first come to London. It was the grandest building she had ever been inside. They tested the echo of their voices in the interior whispering gallery and read the inscription left by Christopher Wren.
"Si monumentum requiris, circum spice."
If you seek his monument, look about you. Will had explained to her what it had meant, that Wren preferred to be remembered by the works he had built rather than any tombstone. The whole of the cathedral was a monument to his craft, as, in a way, the whole of this labyrinth beneath the mountain, and this room especially, was a monument to Mortmain's. There was a domed ceiling here, too, though there were no windows,
only an upward-reaching hollow in the stone. A circular gallery ran around the upper part of the dome, and there was a platform on it, from which, presumably, one could stand and look down at the floor, which was smooth stone. There was an inscription on the wall here, too. Four sentences, cut into the wall in glittering quartz. The infernal devices are without pity. The infernal devices are without regret. The infernal devices are without number. The infernal devices will never stop coming. On the stone floor, lined up in rows, were hundreds of automatons. They wore a motley assortment of military uniforms and were deadly still, their metal eyes closed. Tin soldiers, Ceci thought, grown to human size. The infernal devices. Mort means great creation, an army bred to be unstoppable, to slaughter shadowhunters, and to move onward without remorse. Sophie had been the first to discover the room. She had screamed, and the others had all rushed to find out why. They had found Sophie standing, shaking, amid the unmoving mass of clockwork creatures. One of them lay at her feet. She had cut its legs from under it with the sweep of her blade, and it had crumpled like a puppet whose strings had been cut. The others had not moved or awakened, despite the fate of their associate, which had given the shadow hunters the boldness to go forward among them. Henry was on his knees now, beside the carapace of one of the still unmoving automatons. He had slit open its uniform and opened its metal chest and was studying what was within. The Silent Brothers stood about him, as did Charlotte, Sophie, and Bridget. Gideon and Gabriel had returned as well, their explorations having proved fruitless. Only Magnus and Cyril had not returned. Cecily could not fight down her mounting unease, not at the presence of the automatons, but at the absence of her brother. No one had found him yet. Could it be that he was not here to be found? She said nothing, however. She had promised herself that as a shadow hunter she would not fuss or scream, whatever happened.
"Look at this," Henry murmured in a low voice.
Inside the chest of the clockwork creature was a mess of wires and what looked to Cecily like a metal box, the kind that might hold tobacco. Carved on the outside of the box was a symbol of a serpent swallowing its own tail.
"The Ouroboros, the symbol of containment of demon energies."
"As on the Pyxis," Charlotte nodded.
"Which Mortmain stole from us," Henry confirmed. "It had concerned me that this was what Mortmain was attempting."
"That what was what he was attempting?" Gabriel demanded. He was flushed, his green eyes bright. Bless Gabriel, Cecily thought, for always asking exactly the question that was on his mind.
"Animating the automatons," Henry said absently, reaching for the box. "Giving them consciousness. Even will..."
He broke off as his fingers touched the box, and it flared suddenly into light. Light, like the illumination of a witch-like runestone, poured from the box and through the Ouroboros. Henry jerked back with a cry, but it was already too late. The creature sat up, lightning fast, and seized hold of him. Charlotte shrieked and threw herself forward, but she was not fast enough. The automaton, its chest still hanging grotesquely open, caught Henry under the arms and cracked his body like a whip. There was a terrible snapping sound, and Henry went limp. The automaton tossed Henry aside and turned to cuff Charlotte brutally across the face. She crumpled beside her husband's body as the clockwork creature took a step forward and seized hold of Brother Micah. The Silent Brother slammed his staff down on the automaton's hand, but the creature did not even seem to notice. With a rumble of machinery that sounded like a laugh, it reached out and tore the Silent Brother's throat open. Blood sprayed across the room, and Cecily did exactly what she had promised herself she would not do, and screamed.
Chapter 21 Burning Gold. Bring me my bow of burning gold. Bring me my arrows of desire. Bring me my spear, O clouds unfold. Bring me my chariot of fire. William Blake, Jerusalem.
Tessa's training at the Institute had never addressed how difficult it was to run with a weapon strapped to your side. With every stride she took, the dagger slapped against her leg, its point scratching her skin. She knew it ought to have been sheathed, and on Will's belt probably had been, but there was no use in hindsight now. Will and Magnus were running pell-mell down the rocky corridors inside Cadda Idris, and she was doing her level best to keep up. It was Magnus who was leading the way, as he seemed to have the best idea where they were going. Tessa had gone nowhere inside the morass of twisty corridors without being blindfolded, and Will admitted he remembered little of his solitary journey of the night before. The tunnels narrowed and widened again haphazardly as the three of them made their way through the labyrinth, with no seeming rhyme or reason to the pattern. At last, as they moved into a wider tunnel, they heard something. The sound of a distant cry of horror. Magnus went tense all over. Will's head jerked up. "Cecily," he said, and then he was running twice as fast as he had been, both Magnus and Tessa racing to keep up. They hurtled by strange chambers, one whose doors seemed splashed with blood, another Tessa recognized as the room with the desk where Mortmain had forced her to change, and another where a great lattice of metal and copper twisted in an invisible wind. As they raced forward, the sounds of cries and battle grew louder, until finally they burst into a massive circular chamber. It was full of automatons, row upon row of them, as many as had poured down on the village the night before, while Tessa had watched helplessly. Most of them were still, but a group of them, in the center of the room, were moving, moving and engaged in a fierce battle. It was like seeing all over again what had happened on the steps of the Institute, as she had been dragged away. The Lightwood brothers fighting side by side, Cecily swinging a shimmering seraph blade, the body of a Silent Brother crumpled on the floor. Tessa registered distantly that two other Silent Brothers were fighting alongside the Shadowhunters, anonymous in their hooded parchment robes, but her attention was not on them. It was on Henry, who lay, still and unmoving, on the floor. Charlotte crumpled on her knees, had her arms about him, as if she could shield him from the churning battle going on all around them, but Tessa guessed from the whiteness of his face and stillness of his body that it was too late to shield Henry from anything. Will darted forward.
"No seraph blades," he cried. "Fight them with other weapons. The angel blades are useless."
Cecily, hearing him, jerked back even as her seraph blade connected with the automaton she was fighting, and crumbled away like dry frost, its fire gone. She had the presence of mind to duck beneath the creature's swinging arm, just as Cyril and Bridget plunged toward her, Cyril laying about him with a stout staff. The automaton went down under Cyril's assault, as Bridget, a flying menace of red hair and steely blades, sliced her way past Cecily to Charlotte's side, shearing the arms off two automatons with her sword before whirling about, her back to Charlotte, as if she meant to protect the head of the Institute with her life. Will's hands were suddenly tight on Tessa's upper arms. She caught a glimpse of his white, set face as he pushed her toward Magnus, hissing,
"Stay with her!"
Tessa began to protest, but Magnus caught hold of her, drawing her back even as Will dashed into the melee, fighting his way toward his sister. Cecily was fending off a massive barrel-chested automaton with two arms on its right side. Seraph blade abandoned, she had only a short sword to defend herself. Her hair began to slip free of its fastenings as she lunged forward, stabbing at the creature's shoulder. It roared like a bull, and Tessa shuddered.
God, these creatures made such sounds.
Before Mortmain had changed them, they had been silent. They had been things. Now they were beings. Malevolent, murderous beings. Tessa started forward as the automaton fighting Cecily seized the blade of her weapon and jerked it out of her grasp, pulling her forward. She heard Will call out his sister's name. And Cecily was caught and thrown to the side by one of the Silent Brothers. In a whirl of parchment robes, he spun to face the creature, staff held before him. As the automaton lurched toward him, the brother swung out with the staff with such speed and force that the automaton was knocked back, its chest dented inward. It tried to move forward again, but its body was too badly bent. It gave an angry whir, and Cecily, scrambling back up to her feet, cried out a warning. Another automaton had loomed up beside the first. As the Silent Brother turned, the second automaton knocked the staff from his hand and seized him, lifting him off his feet, wrapping its metal arm around his body from behind, in the parody of an embrace. The brother's hood fell back, and his silvery hair shone out in the dim chamber like starlight. All the air rushed out of Tessa's lungs in a single instant. The silent brother was Jem. Jem. It was as if the world had stopped. Every figure was still, even the automatons frozen in time. Tessa stared across the room at Jem, and he looked back at her. Jem, in the parchment robes of a silent brother. Jem, whose silvery hair, tumbling over his face, was threaded through with black. Jem, whose cheeks were scarred with two matching red cuts, one over each cheekbone. Jem, who was not dead. Tessa, jerked from her frozen shock, heard Magnus say something to her, felt him reach for her arm, but she tore away from him and plunged into the melee. He shouted after her, but all she saw was Jem. Jem seizing at the automaton's arm where it wrapped his throat, his scrabbling fingers unable to find a purchase on the smooth metal. Its grip tightened, and Jem's face began to suffuse with blood as he strangled. She drew her dagger, slashing out in front of her to clear a path, but she knew it was impossible, knew she couldn't get to him in time. The automaton gave a roar and toppled forward. Its legs had been sliced clean through from behind, and as it fell, Tessa saw Will rising from a crouch, a long-bladed sword in his hand. He reached out for the automaton as if he could catch it, prevent its fall, but it had already crashed to the floor, half on top of Jem, whose staff had rolled from his hand. Jem lay still, pinned by the massive machine above him. Tessa darted forward, ducking under the outstretched arm of a clockwork creature. She heard Magnus shout something from behind her, but ignored it. If she could get to Jem before he was badly hurt, even crushed. But as she ran, a shadow fell across her vision. She skidded to a stop and looked up into the face of a leering automaton, reaching for her with clawed fingers. The force of the fall and the weight of the automaton on his back knocked the air from Jem's lungs as he hit the ground, bruisingly hard. For a moment, stars danced across his vision, and he fought for breath, his chest spasming. Before he had become a silent brother, before they had put the first ritual knife to his skin and cut the lines into his face that would begin the process of his transformation, the fall, the injury, might have killed him. Now, as he sucked the air back into his lungs, he found himself twisting, reaching for his staff, even as the creature's hand closed on his shoulder. And a shudder went through its body, along with the ring of metal on metal. Jem seized up his staff and jabbed it upward, knocking the automaton's head sideways, even as the top half of its body was lifted off him and thrown to the side. He kicked out at the weight still pinning his legs, and then that was gone too, and Will was on his knees beside him where he lay on the ground, Will's face as white as ashes. "Jem," he said. There was a stillness around them both, a gap in the battle, an eerie, timeless silence. The weight of a thousand things was in Will's voice, disbelief and amazement, relief and betrayal. Jem began to struggle up onto his elbows, just as Will's sword, smeared with black oil, riven with dents, clattered to the ground. "You're dead," Will said. "I felt you die." And he put his hand over his heart, on his blood-stained shirt, where his parabatine rune was. "Here." Jem scrabbled for Will's hand, caught it in his, and pressed the fingers of his blood brother's hand to the inside of his own wrist. He willed his parabatai to understand. "Feel my pulse, the beat of blood under my skin. Silent brothers have hearts, and they beat." Will's blue eyes widened. "I did not die. I changed. If I could have told you, if there was a way..." Will stared at him, his chest rising and falling quickly. The automaton had clawed one side of Will's face. He was bleeding from several deep scratches, but he didn't appear to notice. He drew his hand back from Jem's grasp and exhaled softly. "Rodni medhu dvar du wirimen dembith," he said. He spoke, without thinking, in Welsh, but Jem understood the words regardless. The runes of the silent brothers meant that no language was unknown to him. "I thought you were gone forever." "I'm still here," Jem said, and then there was a flicker at the corner of his eye, and he moved swiftly, spinning aside. A metal axe whistled down through the space where he had just been, and clanged against the stone floor. Automatons had surrounded them, a ring of whirring metal. And Will was on his feet, sword in hand, and they were back to back. And Will was saying, "There is no rune effective against them. They must be hacked apart by main force. I care of that." Jem gripped his staff and swung it hard, knocking one automaton back into a nearby wall. Sparks flew from its metal carapace. Will struck with his blade, slicing through the jointed knees of two creatures. "I like that stick of yours," he said. "It's a staff." Jem swung out to knock another automaton sideways. "Made by the Iron Sisters, only for Silent Brothers." Will lunged forward, slicing his blade cleanly through the neck of another automaton. Its head rolled to the ground, and a mixture of oil and vapor poured from its ragged throat.
"Anyone can sharpen a stick."
"It's a staff," Jem repeated, and he saw Will's quicksilver smile out of the corner of his eye. Jem wanted to grin back. There was a time when he would have grinned back naturally, but something in the change that had been wrought in him put what felt like the distance of years between him and such simple mortal gestures. The room was a mass of moving bodies and swinging weapons. Jem could see none of the other shadow hunters clearly. He was aware of Will next to him, matching his stride to Jem's, matching him blow for blow. As metal rang on metal, some inner part of Jem, some part that had been lost without his even knowing it was lost, felt the pleasure of fighting together with Will one last time.
"Whatever you say, James," said Will. "Whatever you say."
Tessa swung around, bringing her dagger up, and plunged it into the creature's metal carapace. The blade punched through with an ugly ripping sound, followed by, her heart sank, a gravelly laugh.
"Miss Gray," said a deep voice, and she looked up to see the smooth face of Armaros. "Surely you know better than that. No weapon that small can cut me apart, nor do you have the strength." Tessa opened her mouth to scream, but his clawed hands seized her, and he swung her up into his arms, clamping his hand over her mouth to stifle her cry. Through the haze of movement in the room, the flash of swords and metal, she saw Will cutting apart the automaton that had fallen on Jem. He reached to move it, just as Armaros snarled into her ear.
"I may be made of metal, but I have the heart of a demon, and my demon heart yearns to feast on your flesh."
Armaros began to carry Tessa backward, through the fighting, even as she kicked at him with her boots. He tore her head to the side, his sharp fingers ripping the skin of her cheek.
"You can't kill me," she gasped. "The angel I wear protects my life."
"Oh no, it is true I cannot kill you, but I can hurt you, and I can hurt you most exquisitely. I have no flesh with which to feel pleasure, so the only pleasures left to me are causing pain. While the angel at your throat protects you, as do the orders of the Magister, I must stay my hand. But were the angel's power to fail, should it ever fail, I would rip you apart in my metal jaws."
They were outside the circle of fighting now, and the demon was carrying her into an alcove, part hidden by a pillar of stone.
"Do it. I'd rather die by your hands than be married to Mortmain."
"Don't worry," he said,
and while he spoke without breath, his words still felt like a whisper against her skin, making her shudder in horror. Cold metal fingers circled her arms like manacles as he drew her into the shadows.
"I will make sure of both."
Cecily saw her brother slice out the automaton, attacking Brother Zachariah. The roar of metal as it collapsed forward tore her eardrums. She started toward Will, seizing a dagger from her belt, and then toppled forward as something closed about her ankle, jerking her off her feet. She hit the ground on knees and elbows, and twisted about to see that what had caught at her was the disembodied hand of an automaton. Sliced off at the wrist, black fluid pumping from the wires that still protruded from the jagged metal, its fingers were digging into her gear. She twisted and pivoted, hacking at the thing until its fingers loosened and separated and it clattered to the ground like a dead crab, twitching faintly. She groaned in disgust and staggered to her feet, only to find that she could no longer see Will or Brother Zachariah. The room was a chaotic blur of motion. She saw Gabriel, back to back with his brother, a pile of dead automatons at their feet. Gabriel's gear was torn at the shoulder, and he was bleeding. Cyril lay crumpled on the ground. Sophie had moved to be near him, slashing out in a circle with her sword, her scar livid in her pale face. Cecily could not see Magnus, but she could see the trail of blue sparks in the air that indicated his presence. And then there was Bridget, visible in flashes between the moving bodies of clockwork creatures, her weapon a blur, her red hair like a burning banner, and at her feet. Cecily began to fight her way through the crowd toward them. Halfway there she dropped her dagger, picking up a long-handled axe that one of the automatons had dropped. It was surprisingly light in her grasp, and made a very satisfying crunch when she drove the blade into the chest of a mechanical demon that had reached to seize her, sending the automaton spinning backward. And then she was leaping over a crumpled pile of fallen automatons, most of which had been hacked apart, their limbs scattered, no doubt the source of the hand that had seized her ankle. At the far end of the pile was Bridget, whirling this way and that as she beat back the tide of clockwork monsters threatening to advance on Charlotte and Henry. Bridget spared Cecily only a glance as the younger girl darted by her and dropped to her knees beside the head of the Institute.
"Charlotte," Cecily whispered.
Charlotte looked up. Her face was white with shock, her pupils so wide they seemed to have swallowed the light brown of her eyes. Her arms were wrapped around Henry, his head lolling back against her fragile shoulder, her hands locked about his chest. He seemed entirely limp.
"Charlotte," Cecily said again, "we cannot win this fight. We must retreat."
"I cannot move Henry."
"Charlotte, he's past our help now."
"No, he's not," Charlotte said wildly. "I can still feel his pulse."
Cecily reached out a hand.
"Charlotte,
I am not mad. He is alive. He is alive, and I will not leave him."
"Charlotte, the baby," Cecily said. "Henry would want you to save yourselves."
Something flickered in Charlotte's eyes. She tightened her grip on Henry.
"Without Henry, we cannot leave," she said. "We cannot make a portal. We are trapped in this mountain."
Cecily's breath went out of her in a little gasp. She had not thought of that. Her heart pounded a sharp message through her veins.
"We are going to die. We are all going to die."
Why had she chosen this? My God, what had she done? She raised her head, saw a familiar flash of blue and black at the corner of her vision. Will? The blue reminded her of something, of sparks rising above the smoke.
"Bridget," she said, "get Magnus."
Bridget shook her head.
"If I leave you, you'll be dead in 5 minutes," she said.
As if to illustrate her point, she brought her blade down on a charging automaton as if she was splitting kindling. The creature fell to both sides, sliced down the middle in two equal parts.
"You don't understand," Cecily said. "We need Magnus."
"I'm here," and he was, appearing above Cecily so suddenly and soundlessly that she stifled a scream. There was a long cut along his collar, shallow but bloody. Warlocks bled as red as humans did, it seemed. His gaze fell on Henry, and a terrible, fathomless sadness crossed his face. It was the look of a man who had seen hundreds die, who had lost and lost and lost, and was facing loss once more.
"God," he said, "he was a good man."
"No," Charlotte said, "I am telling you, I felt his pulse. Do not speak of him as if he is gone already."
Magnus dropped to his knees and reached out a hand to touch Henry's eyelids. Cecily wondered if he planned to say, "Awe aque wale," the requisite farewell for Shadowhunters, but instead he jerked his hand back, his eyes narrowing. A moment later, his fingers were against Henry's throat. He muttered something in a language Cecily didn't understand, then slid closer, his hand rising to cup Henry's jaw.
"Slow," he said, half to himself. "Slow, but his heart is beating."
Charlotte took a ragged breath.
I told you.
Magnus's eyes flicked up to her.
You did. I'm sorry for not listening.
His gaze dropped back down to Henry. Now be quiet, everyone. He raised the hand that was not pressed to Henry's throat and snapped his fingers. Instantly, the air around them seemed to thicken and warp like old glass. A solid dome had appeared over them, trapping Henry, Charlotte, Cecily, and Magnus in a shimmering bubble of silence. Through it, Cecily could still see the room around them, the battling automatons, Bridget laying waste right and left with her black smeared blade. Inside, all was quiet. She looked quickly at Magnus.
You've made a protective wall.
Yes.
His attention was on Henry.
Very good.
Couldn't you just make one of those all around us and keep it that way? Keep us all protected?
Magnus shook his head.
Magic takes energy, little one. I could hold such a protection together for only a short time, and when it fell apart, they would fall upon us.
He leaned forward, murmuring something, and a spark of blue leaped from his fingertips to Henry's skin. The pale blue fire seemed to burrow in, striking a sort of fire through Henry's veins, for as if Magnus had touched a match to one end of a line of gunpowder, trails of fire burned up his arms, tracing his neck and face. Charlotte, holding him, gasped as his body spasmed, his head jerking forward. Henry's eyes flew open. They were tinted with the same blue fire that burned through his veins.
His voice was rough. What happened?
Charlotte burst into tears.
Henry, oh my darling Henry.
She clutched at him and kissed him frantically, and he threaded his fingers into her hair and held her there, and both Magnus and Cecily looked away. When at last Charlotte let Henry go, still stroking his hair and murmuring, he struggled to sit up and slumped back down. His eyes met Magnus's. Magnus looked down and away, his eyelids drooping with exhaustion and something else, something that made Cecily's heart tighten.
Henry, Charlotte said, sounding a little frightened. Is the pain bad? Can you stand?
There's little pain, Henry said, but I cannot stand. I cannot feel my legs at all.
Magnus was still staring at the floor.
I am sorry, he said. There are some things magic cannot do, some injuries it cannot touch.
The look on Charlotte's face was awful to see.
Henry.
I can still make a portal,
Henry interrupted. Blood trickled from the corner of his mouth. He wiped it away with the sleeve.
We can escape this place. We must retreat.
He tried to turn to look about him and winced, whitening.
What is happening?
We are far outnumbered, said Cecily. Everyone is fighting for their lives.
For their lives, but not to win, Henry asked.
Magnus shook his head. We cannot win. There is no hope. There are too many of them.
And Tessa? And Will?
Will found her, Cecily said. They are here, in the room.
Henry closed his eyes, breathed in hard, and then opened them again. The blue tinge had already begun to fade.
Then we must make a portal. But first, we must get everyone's attention. Separate them from the automatons, so that they are not all sucked through the portal to the Institute together. The last thing we need is any of those infernal devices winding up in London.
He looked at Magnus.
Reach into the pocket of my coat.
As Magnus reached out, Cecily saw that his hand was trembling slightly. Clearly the effort of keeping the protective wall solid around them was beginning to take its toll on him. He withdrew his hand from Henry's pocket. In it was a small golden box, with no visible hinges or opening. Henry's words came with difficulty.
Cecily, take it, please. Take it and throw it, as hard and as far as you can.
Magnus handed over the box to Cecily with shaking fingers. It felt warm against her hand, though she could not tell if that was from some heat inside it, or simply the result of its having been in Henry's pocket.
She glanced down at Magnus. His face was drawn. I'm letting the wall down now, he said.
Throw, Cecily.
He raised his hands. Sparks flew. The wall shimmered and vanished. Cecily drew her arm back and threw the box. For a moment nothing happened. Then there was a dull implosion, a vanishing inward of sound, as if everything in the room were being sucked down an enormous drain. Cecily's ears popped, and she sank to the ground, clapping her hands to the sides of her head. Magnus was also on his knees, and their small group huddled together as what seemed like a massive wind blew through the room. The wind roared, and joining the sound of the wind was the sound of creaking, tearing metal as the clockwork creatures in the room began to stagger and stumble. Cecily saw Gabriel dart out of the way as an automaton fell at his feet and began spasming, its iron arms and legs flailing as if it were in the throes of a fit. Her eyes darted to Will and the silent brother he fought beside, whose herd had fallen back. Even among everything else that was happening, Cecily felt a shock go through her. Brother Zachariah was... Jem. She had known, they had all known, that Jem had gone to the Silent City to become a silent brother, or die trying, but that he would be well enough to be here now, with them, fighting beside Will as he used to, that he would have the strength. There was a crash as a clockwork monster crumpled to the ground between Will and Jem, forcing them to spring apart. The air smelled like the air just before a storm.
Henry!
Charlotte's hair blew about her face. Henry's face was tight with pain.
It's a sort of pyxis, meant to detach demon souls from their bodies before death. I haven't had time to perfect it, but it seemed worth trying.
Magnus, staggering to his feet, his voice rose over the sound of crumpling metal and the high shrieks of demons.
Come here, all of you! Gather, Shadowhunters!
Bridget stood her ground, still fighting two automatons whose movements had become jerky and uneven, but the others began to run toward them. Will, Jem, Gabriel. But Tessa? Where was Tessa? Cecily saw Will realize Tessa's absence at the same time that she did. He turned, his hand on Jem's arm, his blue eyes scanning the room. She saw his lips form the word, Tessa, though she could hear nothing over the ever louder shrieking of the wind, the shuddering of metal.
Stop!
A bolt of silvery light shot down like a fork of lightning from the top of the dome and exploded through the room like the sparks of a Catherine wheel. The wind stilled and stopped, leaving the room filled with a ringing silence. Cecily looked up. On the gallery, halfway up the dome, stood a man in a well-cut dark suit, a man she recognized instantly. It was Mortmain.
Stop!
The voice echoed through the room, sending chills through Tessa's veins. Mortmain. She knew his speech, his voice, even though she could see nothing past the stone pillar that hid the alcove Armros had dragged her into. The demon automaton had kept a tight hold on her, even as the dull explosion had rocked the room, followed by a biting, vicious wind that had blown past their alcove, leaving them untouched. Silence had fallen now, and Tessa wanted desperately to tear away from the metal arms that held her, to run into the room and see if any of her friends, those she loved, had been harmed, even killed. But struggling against him was like struggling against a wall. She kicked out anyway, just as Mortmain's voice rang through the room again.
Where is Miss Greer? Bring her to me!
Armras made a rumbling noise and lurched into motion. Lifting Tessa by the arms, he carried her from the alcove into the main room. It was a scene of chaos. The automatons stood frozen, looking up at their master. Many were crumpled on the ground or hacked into pieces. The floor was slippery with a mixture of blood and oil. In the center of the room, in a circle, stood the shadow hunters and their companions. Cyril was kneeling upon the ground, a torn piece of bloody bandage wrapped around his leg. Near him was Henry, half sitting and half lying down in Charlotte's arms. He was pale, so pale. Tessa's eyes met Will's as he raised his head and saw her. A look of dismay passed over his face, and then he started forward. Jem seized his sleeve. His eyes were on Tessa too. They were wide and dark and full of horror. She looked away from both of them, away and up at Mortmain. He stood at the railing of the gallery above them, like a preacher at a pulpit, and smirked down. "Miss Grey," he said, "so good of you to join us." She spat